Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the new edition of TLS Voices. My name is Stig Abel, editor of the Times Literary Supplement. I'm joined as ever by the commissioning editor and the podcast's unchallenged pronunciation guru, Thea Lenadutzi. Thea, you have just been skiing, which is a dreadfully middle-class way of getting cold and showing off. And you've got 5 seconds to bore on about it if you'd like to.
I couldn't possibly, except to say that if it's supposed to be about showing off, I'm sure I was doing something wrong.
Also, as an Italian, it's not quite as bad. If you're an Italian, you grew up in Italy.
Yes.
Skiing is not a kind of middle-class
show. No, I also grew up basically on the Swiss border, so.
Skiing's acceptable.
Yes.
It's not showing off.
No.
And was it fun?
It was. It's amazing how much one forgets. It had been 15 years since I'd last attempted to ski.
But you did it successfully.
My limbs were quite uncontrollable.
But you didn't plummet off anything.
I didn't plummet off anything. I'm here to tell the tale.
There we go.
The boring tale.
Yeah, well, that's what I said. Skiing is boring. But I think if you're Italian, you have an excuse. Before we get to the show, I want to tell you a way you can get cheap subscriptions to the TLS. Simply Google TLS subscriptions, click and type POD1 in the offer code tab. You can get 6 issues for just £6. So just Google TLS subscriptions and type POD1 in the offer code bit and you'll get that deal. Coming up on the programme today, 2017 is the bicentennial of Jane Austen's death. What does she mean in the modern world exactly? We have a cover piece by Austen expert and roller derby enthusiast Devaney Lucer, whose roller derby name is the unimprovable Stone Cold Jane Austen. I'm mildly terrified to say she'll be joining us shortly. Last year, the most recommended book in the TLS Books of the Year was the final volume of Letters by Samuel Beckett. David Wheatley has reviewed them and will talk to us about the end of this iconic literary life. Finally, we shall reflect on a memoir by superstar American editor Robert Gottlieb, who ran two publishing houses, Simon & Schuster and Alfred A. Knopf, as well as The New Yorker. J. Michael Lennon, the Norman Mailer literary executor, has reviewed it and will be on the line. It is a truth universally acknowledged that the opening line of Pride and Prejudice must be referenced at the beginning of any item about its author, Jane Austen. This year, the 200th anniversary of her death, you're likely to see Austen everywhere, peeking out demurely from her portrait in reissued books and new critical works, even endorsing a brand of gin, which calls her quite a naughty girl who liked her young men and liked her gin. We seem to feel a natural affinity with this writer for unclear reasons. It's perhaps because we long for a world which, however realist, always seems to end in harmony, the reassuring conclusion of concord and marriage. Martin Amis once brilliantly noticed, by the way, that the particular genius of Jane Austen was to turn us all into Mrs. Bennets. We lust after a happy ending with a whale-heeled suitor, no less hysterically than that woman who we've been invited to laugh at throughout. Devaney Lucer, Stone Cold Jane Austen, if I might be so bold, has reviewed a new issue of Mansfield Park and a critical work entitled Jane Austen, The Secret Radical by Helena Kelly. She joins Thea and me now. Devaney, what's the current trend for regarding Austen? I presume this sort of peaks and troughs. Is she a dutiful social historical novelist, or is she, as this new book suggests, a secret radical? What's the sort of trend around Jane Austen at the moment?
Well, I think the trend goes in all directions, which is absolutely what her popular and scholarly history would suggest. The trend seems to be now to find her a lot more fun and a lot more, what my students would call relatable, right? That she's a lot more of an everyday gal, I think, in the current moment, at least in her popular history, than she's been in the past.
And why is that? What do you think we're looking for with her? Is it because there's sort of happy endings? Is it because there's strong female characters, and in some senses she's a little bit more modern than what one might otherwise think.
Well, you know, I heard you suggest at the beginning, along with Martin Amis, that you think she might be a kind of escapist author or a romantic fantasy author. And I see her more as a social critic, along with the books in review. I think everyone always wants to know what Jane Austen would think of such and such. But the only thing that an answer to that question ever tells us, I believe, is what the person answering it most appreciates about Jane Austen.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I most appreciate about her is her feminist social criticism, her satire, and her humor. But the fact that one can go to her novels and find all of these things and satisfy all of these audiences is what I think is remarkable about her.
And the radical badge, that's nothing new, is it? I mean, you mention, among others from previous generations, that the suffragettes were Janeite kind of banner wavers.
Yes, this idea that Austen has been used for progressive politics has been with us for more than a century. And I love the fact that the suffragists marched through the streets of London in 1908 with this Jane Austen banner and other women writers' names on banners, but that she could be rallied for a particular political cause 100 years after she died is, I think, fantastic. And it shows us that the Twitter wars over putting her on currency are not a new fact.
What were the Twitter wars around? I vaguely remember this. That was she not included originally on a piece of currency, and then the argument was that she should be?
Well, I'm talking about the very recent one with Cristina Caralda Perez.
Yeah.
And the, yes. There was a movement to get another woman on English currency, and Caralda Perez was one of the major activists. And when it was named that Jane Austen would be put on, it was the tenor ultimately that she'll be on next year or this year, right? There was a series of death threats, rape threats, and I think two people ultimately were convicted. And I don't know if they plea bargained out. I'm not sure. You'd have to look back at the record. But there was a court case over their Twitter threats to Caralda Perez.
I do remember that. But I wonder whether that was that so much about Jane Austen as about men with crazy ideas that you can't have women on currency. Because I'm kind of interested, because what were her revolutionary ideas? Because you say that she's, you know, the suffragettes used her, you quote William Dean Howells as saying she was in her way asserting the rights of man as unmistakably as the French revolutionists. And I've read all of Austen, I think, and I was scratching my head a bit. Where did these revolutionary ideas appear in her work?
Well, I think they're much more having to do with gender than with class. And so picking and choosing, when we use the term progressive to refer to Austen's fiction. And I think that's okay. So I think, for instance, the comments that she makes on women being governesses, that she has in Jane Fairfax's mouth in Emma, are seen as remarkable, right? She has Jane Fairfax refers to governesses as the sale of human intellect, maybe not human flesh, she says, but human intellect. And I think that's a really moving and insightful moment to see the ways in which educated women's roles were limited and the ways in which they were treated like, you know, I think she's likening it to slavery, which I know is controversial, but interesting, and I think progressive.
It strikes me as quite an important line that you quote from Claudia L. Johnson and her work on Austen. And the line says basically that Austen de-polemicized but did not depoliticize her work. That strikes me as an important distinction. I think presumably that's part of what allows us to continue to engage with her, and it doesn't sort of make the text too much of its time. It keeps it relevant. It allows the reader space to think for themselves.
Absolutely. And, you know, I love Claudia Johnson's work. And for my money, the Jane Austen Women Politics in the novel that I referenced in the review is still the best study making sense of Austen's political investments in the fiction as best we can make them out. And I really like the idea that she is put forward as someone who has, of course, political investments, but is not making people angry. She's bringing them along by degrees. And I would call that a more liberal position, a within the institution position for change, not a radical or revolutionary position. To me, that speaks most to what I see going on in her novels and in the materials we have surviving about her life.
Why do you think the survival of Jane Austen, I think, is very interesting and we'll be confronted by over this year. Why do we still feel proximity to her in a way no one does feel close to Walter Scott, for example? Is that because the quality of the writing or, you know, for some reason, modern adaptations? I mean, in this country, there is a sort of iconic BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, which had Colin Firth as Mr. Darcy emerging half naked from a lake, which kind of set the hearts aflutter a bit.
And yes, we know that one over here in the States too.
Oh, really? Yeah. And there was Emma was obviously reimagined in Clueless, the Alicia Silverstone movie. Have modern adaptations had a part to play into making her relatable, as you say your students would call her?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think part of the reason this is on my mind so closely is I've just finished a book called The Making of Jane Austen, which will be out in June from Johns Hopkins University Press, if you let me get that plug in. But it looks at her reputation up to 1975. And what I've found looking through book illustration, stage adaptation, the way she's used in politics and schools, is that Jane Austen in each generation has made the leap to whatever the new media is in that day. And I think as long as that keeps happening for her, she will continue to travel with us. And, you know, Sir Walter Scott ultimately didn't. You know, we've got that fantastic monument up in Edinburgh, and no one seems to read his novels anymore. But I think when Austen makes these leaps into these new media, she's speaking to audiences that are popular and scholarly with equal verve, and that's a very unusual thing.
But how worried do you think we should be, or should we not be, about these multimedia distortions of Jane Austen and Jane Austen's work? You know, these portrayals of her in, as you say, as a flirty boozer.
Okay, I can tell you I am zero worried about the flirty boozer and what that's going to do to her long-term possibilities for continued positive reception. You know, I think in Austen's case, she legitimately started as popular before scholarly, although we don't often think of that in those terms.
Do you extend that to, because, you know, we talked about Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and it must be odd that I'm now speaking to someone else who's seen Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and we'll get your reaction on that. But does it matter that you say that there's a porn version of Jane Austen or there's a zombie version of Jane Austen? do you not feel protective in any way, or is that just, you know, lets a thousand flowers bloom, I suppose?
You know, I think I used to feel more protective, but I've increasingly come out of the question that why Jane Austen is the wrong way for us to pose it. Who's Jane Austen is the better way to pose it. And if all we have left are the porn Jane Austen people for her popular reputation, yes, that worries me.
But I hate to be a killjoy, but we should probably talk about Mansfield Park.
Yeah.
Don't sound too excited.
Well, I don't mind Mansfield Park, but yeah, go on. Yeah, quite right, go on.
Well, we were going to, in your piece, you mentioned the debate surrounding the meaning, I suppose, of Mansfield Park, what it was getting at. So I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that.
Yes. Well, Mansfield Park has been a real flashpoint, as I put it in the review, for conversations about slavery and colonialism in Austen, and I think more widely in the 18th and 19th centuries. And, you know, I think there are many things in the novel that suggest that's a very good way in. And the name Mansfield itself, whether it's connected directly, Deidre Lynch calls Mansfield name-checked in Mansfield Park's title to Lord Mansfield, who's famous for his decision that is said by some to have ended slavery in England in 1772. The legal scholars may differ over how to interpret that.
Norris is there as well, the other name check.
Yes, of course. These are important references, and I don't find them accidental. It seems to me that it's one of the many things that the novel is concerned about and invested in, not a kind of one-to-one correspondence. You know, I don't think the book's secrets are revealed by figuring out that there are these references to slavery, and then we can stop there and say, mystery solved.
And there's another debate which I find quite interesting, actually. It's about the stuff of Fanny Price herself, whether she's an ironic figure or a genuine one. You know, she's a sort of, she's famed for saying no to things, and she doesn't have an appetite, and someone's described her as an archetypal romantic monster. Do you think she is an ironic figure, a kind of a vehicle?
Yeah, I have to say she's a difficult character for me in that she's probably my least favorite among Austen's heroines. So I'm not the best sympathetic critic, perhaps, on her. There's a great line from David Lodge's Changing Places where he talks about the students going around with signs that say Fanny Price is a fink. And, you know, to me, that's highly amusing, and I don't take that as insulting. But I don't find her ironic, I guess, in that way.
It's interesting, actually, because we've got a piece, one of our 20 questions on the website now. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's with Benjamin Markovitz, and he says that Fanny Price is his favourite fictional character of all time. So it just goes to show how, yeah.
Go ahead. So there's a long history to that, too. This goes back to the mid-19th century, when for many people, Mansfield Park, and especially it seems to have been men of a certain class, not to impugn anyone, but who found Mansfield Park to be their most favourite of Austen's texts. Well, long history of this.
Well, then we're going to have to leave it there. But in fact, let's end on me asking that unprofessional question. question. As an Austen scholar, what is your favourite Austen novel? What are you going to shock us with?
What's very funny is this is the exact conversation I had with my husband when I first met him, and he didn't like my answer and pressed me on it. So my answer at the time I met him is Northanger Abbey, which I do find very funny. But in terms of the one that I enjoy rereading most, it would definitely be Pride and Prejudice. Yeah. And I'm totally fine with that being the cliched answer.
Yeah, me too. Because I enjoyed Northanger Abbey, and I think it is interesting and fun. But I think I reread Pride and Prejudice about every 18 months, just and it's kind of naff. And I know I'm being naff as I'm doing it, but I do it.
You know what? We're in good company, and that's okay.
Yeah, exactly, Devon. Thank you very much. We can read Pride and Prejudice.
Like a therapy session.
Yeah, this is cathartic. Devon, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for such a wonderful piece. It's a big year for Jane Austen, so I know you'll be very busy, but it's delightful that you took the time to speak to us.
Such a pleasure, Stig and Thea. Thank you.
Do you have a favorite?
Just a second. Can I say one thing? My name is actually, it's Devonie Loser, and I know you are a pronunciation guru. That's why I say it, Devonie Loser.
Great. Devonie Loser. Okay, well, we can correct that in your intro, can't we?
We can correct it in the intro, or just leave it in at the end. Let's just leave this in just to correct ourselves. You know, we can admit fallibility.
We're so transparent.
Yeah, we need to admit fallibility.
Devonie, I feel like my reputation is on the line.
Yeah. No, you need to admit fallibility, Thea. Devonie, thank you so much.
Have a good day.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Devonie Loser.
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 We would never have got that.
No. How can we be expected to? Go on. You were about to say your favourite Austen novel.
I don't know.
Where do you stand on Austen?
Well, so my mum was very keen to push Austen on me and my sister. My sister immediately took to her. I struggled a little bit, purely because I didn't really, maybe I was too young, I don't know, but for whatever reason, I felt like it was a bit too much drawing rooms and ballrooms and I couldn't relate to it, so maybe that's very modern of me. But I actually remember really liking Mansfield Park, and I wonder whether that was something to do with the wider context. Yeah. I remember the allusions to Antigua and goings on in Antigua and thinking this connects with the wider world. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying I was some 12-year-old political activist or something. But
it felt like the world, yeah, because one of the knocks on her is that the Napoleonic Wars are going on.
Yeah.
And no one really knows about it.
Well, exactly. And certainly in, is it in Emma, the Napoleonic Wars? Persuasion.
Persuasion,
they've already ended when the
Persuasion's
novel
the
starts.
Last one. I quite like Persuasion.
Yeah, I did as well. But, yeah, I don't know, there was something about the broader context and also the sort of not being told what to think, but knowing that there's some thinking that we need to do here.
Yeah, how interesting. It's quite hard to read the whole oeuvre of a novelist, a major novelist, and because there's six novels and a little bit of Marginalia or Juvenilia, you can do that with Jane Austen.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting in itself. It's very hard to read all. I mean, you can just about read all of Dickens, but it's quite an effort to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas with Jane Austen, you get a sense of completeness.
It's a kind of, she's a kind of author who certainly lends herself to that binging.
I notice that people call her Jane. When a critic calls an author by the first name, I'm always a bit suspicious. It tends to mean that they're too close.
Mm.
And it happens with female, and they do it with Emily Dickinson.
Mm.
If you read a lot of Emily Dickinson criticism, she's Emily.
Mm.
And she's Jane in some criticism. I think one of the quotes in this piece is Jane. And I don't know whether, maybe it doesn't mean anything, but it just seems a way you slightly diminish someone by calling them by their first name in a critical work. Do you think that's fair or done?
I think it's just it's a way of owning, isn't it? Of flying the flag for that closeness that you have.
You wouldn't call Beckett Samuel.
No. Sam.
Yeah, we wouldn't call him Sam, would you? I wouldn't have thought. Well, let's move on to that. From an icon of Augustan literature to an icon of modern literature, Samuel Beckett. David Wheatley has reviewed the fourth and final volume of Beckett's letters, which cover the period of 1966 to 1989. In them, we discover Beckett the wanderer and holidaymaker, which is quite an unsettling thought, Beckett the Nobel Prize winner in 1969, and Beckett the theatrical grandee. Time spent in the theatre, he said, was the opposite of real work. The letters take us up to his death, ending in November 1989 with one to Michael Kubel saying, "I am ill and cannot help. Forgive, so go ahead without me. We can't go on, we'll go on," as someone once nearly said. And David Wheatley has reviewed the letters, joins us now. David, how are you?
All right, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is it's a period in these letters which sound like fascinating things and kind of beautiful things as well. But Beckett at this point is becoming a bit of a celebrity by the time these letters start. How did that affect him and his work, do you think? And does that come across in the letters he's writing?
Well, I was thinking of a phrase from later on in Yeats's life when he referred to the finished man among his enemies. But by contrast, I think in the later stretches of Beckett's life, were one to pick up Volume 4 without having read Volume 1 in particular, you could quite easily get the sense that this was a man who had no enemies, who was just unbelievably ironic and peaceful and beloved by all he ever encountered.
And how, and because does that affect someone whose stock in trade is absurdism and bleakness and darkness and a recognition of some of the sort of futility inherent in humanity? How does being happy affect him?
Well, one phrase that I had singled out from these later letters, I think it's in a letter to Harold Pinter, is enough about my so-called despair. Now, you may have noticed that simultaneously with Volume 4, there is a volume of his letters to Barney Rossett that has come out, Dear Mr. Beckett. And that volume leans quite heavily on that period of the theatre of the absurd from the 1960s, with many, many people coming up to say that the point of Beckett's writing was that, in fact, life is just unbearable, awful, that we should kill ourselves now. This is one strand, an honourable strand of Beckett criticism, but certainly not reflected by the wider stretch of reading. By my calculation, 3,179 pages, of which the current volume is one quarter.
What did he make of the Nobel Prize? Because, I mean, it's financially very, very nice. And we might get to the obvious question that what he would have made of Bob Dylan winning it 50 years later or 60 years later. But what did he make of it himself, first of all?
I think what he made of it on the most literal level was a holiday opportunity. Each year of these volumes has very helpful chronology. I noticed that in the mid-1970s, he was going down to Morocco or Tunisia up to three times a year. And since the news of the prize found him in North Africa, he decided to make a six-week holiday of it. In fact, he had a stopping over in Portugal on the way home too. And, well, at this point, I think that dialectic of public versus private Beckett that was already quite well established after Godot really begins to kick in, with the sense of having to build this protective wall between him and the public clamouring for his opinions and everything. But I think he was also able to put this dialectic of public and private to very good and self-protective use.
So he was quite protective of his legacy, was he? I mean, there are a number of letters in this collection addressed to and from academics.
He certainly ended up being very shrewd about his legacy. He was very lucky in the choice of people who made a pass to his door, but also shrewd too. This volume contains correspondence with people such as Christopher Ricks and James Nelson. James Nelson organises a little exhibition about him in the University of Reading and strikes up a conversation and a kind of, enduring friendship that culminates in the biography, and also it culminates in the wonderful archive of Beckett material at the University of Reading. And while he would always do the very performative thing of denying being an intellectual or an academic and not really being able to talk about his work or philosophy, he was very, very patient and willing to indulge these people.
Was he not? I mean, what sort of correspondent was he overall in? Was he warm and... You refer later on to the black diamonds of pessimism within the letters, but is your overall impression of someone who is patient and warm and enjoying the act of correspondence?
Very much so. I think that the daily routine of correspondence maybe provided him with the useful pleasures of distraction that nowadays one might associate with just nipping onto the internet for a while before you start writing.
Yeah.
And the complaints about correspondence are, if anything, drowned out by the complaints that bob up when there are threats of postal strikes. And he becomes, I think, quite itchy at the prospect of not being able to receive all of these terrible letters asking him for the true meaning of Waiting for Godot. I can only assume he did not answer every single individual illiterate letter he received, but he did very, very conscientiously answer so many of these things.
I imagine sometimes his economy was the clearest sign of his feelings. There's the shortest letter, which is just no in response to it.
No, and that does form part of a pattern that the statistical breakdown of Volume 4 bears this out, that although the period covered by Volume 4 contains, in fact, it yields the largest amount of letters, they are also statistically the shortest letters, because they do tend to be very brief answers to people asking him to do things he is unwilling or unable to perform.
You make the point, which we've discussed on this podcast, and it keeps coming back. We've got another piece, I think, in next week's paper about letter writing among the poets, that the era of the literary letter writer is coming to an end. And you say that remarkable and epic achievement that this book has been, the collection may function as a memorial twice over. And do you get the sense of that we've got the end of an era in terms of letters, and there is nothing really coming along to replace it? You know, are we going to be looking at Zadie Smith's Facebook posts in contrast?
Well, I hope I'm wrong about that. I am aware of University Archive having acquired the rights to Seamus Healy's hard drive from his computer. What that might yield up, I don't know. I would like to believe there are more great correspondences to come down the line. But obviously technology will have a damaging effect on these.
Well, because ultimately, I mean, is this fair, do you think, that the act of letter writing, even though it could be curt and peremptory sometimes, it is it's a substantial difference to the act of sending off an email or something electronic. By putting pen to paper, you're giving more of yourself, or is this just... I mean, I just wonder whether this is sort of dewy-eyed romanticism on my part, and actually it's more or less the same thing.
I think the elaborate courtesies of correspondence suited Beckett very well. I mentioned Volume 1 before as quite a contrast to Volume 4. Beckett was an angry young man in Volume 1 and was pouring out these very angry diatribes, principally to Thomas McGreevy. But I think he found the codes of politeness, which he channeled into the active correspondence so effectively and at such length, I think he found them very useful ways of diffusing that anger that had, well, bogged him down in his younger days so much. And there, I think, is another aspect of the buffer zone between the man answering his letters and then the secret private artist who is continuing to produce work with such diligence and distinction all the way up to the late 1980s.
And you draw a comparison with the internet and letter writing as a distraction versus the modern distraction of the internet. And the sad thing is that the internet is a passive thing. You know, you if only one could be distracted into another form of writing. It seems almost too good to be true.
Yes, but I suppose another aspect of this that I was struck by in Volume 4, that the very well-established resistance of Beckett to having his work tampered with or crossing genres, but increasingly one finds that breaks down. And he becomes very interested with, for instance, the chance to work in television. And some of those very late plays begin to cross over actors who put suggestions to him for adaptations. And since his death, so much work has been done in all kinds of new genres, video art in particular. And while the terrible cliche of Shakespeare being alive today and writing for EastEnders comes to mind, I don't think that a Beckett who was alive today would merely have a Luddite aversion to the internet. While I'm sure he would engage with it warily, the pattern of his writing all through his life was one of fascination with new technologies. Crabbe's Glass Tape, for instance, if you remember,
is
set in the future because the man in the 1950s with the archive of tape recordings, well, he couldn't have had those tape recordings dating back, so Beckett had to project it on into the future. So, well, you can imagine your own Facebook-based version of Crabbe's Glass Tape.
Well, I can just imagine Beckett on Twitter. You can imagine him sort of saying no on Twitter and it being retweeted sort of 20,000 times by virtue-signalling show-offs who wanted to show that they understood what he was saying.
Well, since you mentioned that, a character who has achieved a degree of celebrity on Twitter is Theodore Adorno, who's famous for saying no to everything on Twitter. And in fact, Adorno pops up in Volume 4. Beckett, I think, was flattered by the attention he was getting from this great critic, but found him ever so slightly difficult and maybe slightly humourless. That comes through as well. But if Adorno could be on Twitter, well then, why can't Beckett?
David, thank you so much for doing the piece. I think what comes across and talking to you even more so, that this is a lovely book. And we, you know, it was the most recommended book in our books of the year at the end of last year as well. There's a sense that this is it's a fine sort of testament to the end of the life of Beckett.
Well, I feel a bit like Alexander the Great sitting down by the waters of the Ganges, crying that there's no new world to conquer yet because we haven't found out about Australia. I just hope someone finds a few more letters down the back of a sofa and gives us another volume at some point in the future.
That'd be great. David, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I just wonder, are there any figures of Beckett's standing writing today, Thea, whose letters you would want to see?
Of his standing is the sticking point, really.
Yeah.
Because you can imagine that there are letters by certain people who you would like to read because of the events, the people they meet, the anecdotal value. But for the philosophical insight or you know, what are they called? The black diamonds of pessimism.
Yeah.
I was
thinking about Nabokov as well, who's obviously alive at the same point. There's a point at which Nabokov and Beckett were alive, and you'd be fascinated to hear their thoughts.
Who are the Nabokov and Beckett of today, if at all? I mean, does that exist? I mean, is it only because you get a sort of patina of greatness by your death and the distance that death brings? It just doesn't feel that. I know all Golden Age is always in the past, but I'm just not sure that there are figures like that that are writing that of equal standing.
I don't know. I think I'd probably agree with you, but it's one of those things that you sort of can't allow yourself to think about too much.
No, it's kind of
feels
a
bit like it also feels a bit like standing on the edge of a precipice.
Yeah, well, it just feels odd that I don't know that. Nabokov,
whose letters now would you?
Would you be like you should really read that they're important literary? Yeah. I mean, Philip.
Maybe someone like Tom Stoppard.
Tom Stoppard, maybe Philip Roth, maybe. Yeah. You know, sort of a great Elena Ferrante. Maybe.
Well, we have some of hers, of course, in the Frantumaglia, recent collection. And those are particularly interesting because you get her interactions with people who are adapting her work. And those are often, I think, the most interesting things. So, yeah, when Samuel Beckett got back to someone who was making an inquiry about adapting one of his things and just said no, you know, instead of doing that, Elena Ferrante really engages with the idea.
Yeah, and I can imagine that.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
We should move on. Talking of literary titans, in fact, we move to a memoir called Avid Reader by Robert Gottlieb, one of the major editorial figures of the 20th century. Gottlieb was the editor-in-chief at The New Yorker between 1982 and 1997 and of two major publishing houses, Simon & Schuster and Knopf, whence he has returned. In his time, he has edited a bristlingly impressive list of writers, including Anthony Burgess, John Cheever, Don DeLillo, Margaret Drabble, Toni Morrison, Doris Lessing, John le Carré, Salman Rushdie and V.S. Naipaul. Ironically for an editor, his memoir is a lengthy, rambling, sprawling affair that by the sounds of it needed a touch of the blue pencil. J. Michael Lennon has given it a respectful but not uncritical review for us and joins Thea and me now. Michael, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. One question for you. We were just talking about whether who are the significant literary figures of today comparable to Nabokov and Beckett. Have you got any names you'd throw into our hat? You know, people whose letters you'd want to read working today?
Well, Cormac McCarthy would be right at the top of my list.
Yeah,
Don DeLillo, DeLillo, McCarthy. I think it's time to start collecting the letters of Dave Eggers, too. I think he's going to be one of the greats.
Yeah, that's a good, yeah. And I imagine you've got to imagine his correspondence in a variety of technological forms would be quite playful and quite interesting.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. McCarthy, though, I think is going to be one of the titans, and he's still producing. We've been waiting for a year or two now for this new novel of his, The Passenger, to come out, and it keeps being delayed and delayed.
Does it?
I think it's Proustian, sort of. He's putting it off while he's still steaming along.
I think Blood Meridian's arguably in the top three books of the 20th century.
Yes. It's a terrific book. It's painful to read it.
Yeah.
The blood just flows through the gutters of the book. It's very painful, but it's a book that one can never forget.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, let's talk about this the Gottlieb book. The writer-editor relationship, I think, is a generally fascinating one. Who are the writers, though? I gave a long list then of pretty big names. Who are the writers that made the most impression on Gottlieb and therefore his memoir? Who are the writers that you come away from this feeling that you know more about?
Jean Le Carré is one. Also, Toni Morrison, Robert Caro is another one. That continues. That's a continuing. That's been going on for 40 years. I suppose it's one of the longest editor-author relationships one can point to in literature. It's Caro's last volume. The fifth volume is still in the works, and there is Bob Gottlieb still working with him, fighting over every single comma and every cut. Caro writes long, and Gottlieb has to cut him back. He has a paperweight on his desk that says, "Give the reader a break." In other words, partner with the reader. Don't over-explain to the reader all the time, so the reader doesn't get bored. And that appears to be where Carol's lack is.
People listening might not know, they might not work in the book business, and I imagine most of them don't. And so they probably want to know, how important is a good editor to a writer's critical success or even commercial success? How important is it? How important is it to have this editor like Bob Gottlieb?
He's indispensable. He's been the indispensable editor for so many years, for so many writers. He's had Nobel Prize winners, Man Booker, a National Book Award. You name the prizes, you know, a host of Pulitzers, and most of them have paid tribute with him, and most of them have stuck with him. Some didn't. DeLillo left him, which I've always wondered, and I've wondered why, and I'd like to ask DeLillo that question someday. But most of his other writers have stuck with him, and they find he has an uncanny ability to find the narrative arc of a story, to know when to pinch it off, when to expand it, and when not to. And he does it with nudges. I mean, he's a line editor, and he'll do line editing, but a lot of his work is just saying, you know, this needs to be bulked up at the end. It's too loose and runny. And he can give that kind of advice. He knows what kind of advice to give to writers, whether he needs to fix broken sentences or whether he has to suggest that the novel really ended halfway through the manuscript, as he told one of his famous writers, and the writer said, you know, you're right. I felt that the last half I didn't really need to write. That's an editor of genius, and he certainly is, one of the great editors of all time. There's no doubt about it.
Just to stick with editing for a second, Toni Morrison makes an interesting point. She says, "I never write with Bob in mind. That would be very bad for me. He isn't the ideal reader for the product, but he is the ideal editor for it." I think that gets to the nub of what it is to be an editor.
Yes, very good, very apt quote. Extremely sharp. Yes, absolutely. They're the same age, and they work together very well. And he convinced her to give up her editing job. She was an editor herself at Random House for many years to make a living. And then when her book started to click, he said, "Look, you've got to get out of this work. You need to write." Well, you know, that shows that he puts the writer first. The editor he always sees as a subsidiary, a character, however essential he may be to the final product. He knows talent when he sees it.
How would you say his role, I mean, not specifically for him, but the role of the editor in the publishing world, how would you say that's changed? Because he's been in it since the 1950s when he started at Simon & Schuster. So it's a very different world now. Do you get much of a sense of that change in his book?
Yes. Well, he's still the old-fashioned editor.
Mm.
He still takes home hard copy and lays up in bed with a pencil and reads fast and so forth. Many other editors are much more executive these days. They expect that their mentors and MFA programs, their agents and their friends are going to churn in perfect copy, and there will be very little to do except you know, decide on the publicity campaign and so forth, and maybe some light editing. But, you know, there are many enclaves of in publishing where the old-fashioned stuff still goes on. I know my editor at Simon & Schuster, Robert Bender, you know, I said, should I send you an electronic copy? He goes, oh, no, get a big box and mail me the whole manuscript of your biography of Mailer. And I did. And I got it back with, you know, in the same big box. And so he's an old-fashioned guy in the Gottlieb tradition. And there's still a lot of those folks in the business.
And did your editor get back to you as quickly as Robert Gottlieb gets back to his people? That's his sort of his signature, isn't it? The speed.
Pretty fast. I gave him, I think, 400,000 words, and he got it back to me in about a month.
400,000 words?
Yeah. That was the first draft, yeah.
Well, let's talk about Mailer briefly, because we'll talk about Gottlieb Reiter very briefly at the end, but, you know, as his biographer, what was his relationship like with his editors?
Mailer?
Yeah, Mailer. Knowing a little bit about the man and his books, it can't have been a straightforward one.
Well, you know, I edited some of Mailer's works myself, and Norman always asked for opinions, and but he often resisted it. He only his wife, his friends, his editors, his agent, everybody told him that something needed to be shortened or expanded or fixed up, would he really listen? He listened very carefully, and as Jason Epstein, another great editor who was Mailer's editor, said, Norman's always very polite. He always asks me questions about this and that, and then he goes off and ignores me completely. I don't think that's exactly true. Mailer would listen to advice, and he was especially interested when someone would point out a flaw in some run of his sentences. He had a great ear for the beat of sentences. And when they didn't sound right, when there was something broken in them, he would listen. And he had a wonderful copy editor named Veronica Windholz, who edited a lot of his books. And she said, I never tried to fool around with his philosophy. She said, I just tried to make his sentences flow a little bit better. And he always listened to that.
And presumably part of the pleasure of some of his books, the length and the scale and the ambition are part of the fun of them. And I suppose if you were to cut too much that, you know, even a book like Harlot's Ghost, which is one of the great spy books, really, you could have made it tighter, I'm sure. And you could have cut some of the musings about the id and all that stuff that Mailer liked doing. But part of the pleasure of Mailer is the slightly excessive nature of the prose.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I love it when he goes off on long excursions like that. He never knows if he's going to be able to find his way back. But some of the excursions are some of the great passages in his book. But, you know, they're excrescences. I mean, you could lop them off for the sake of having a more comely narrative that flowed beautifully and no extra words, you know, a great Gatsby kind of a book or a Scarlet Letter. But Norman always felt that, you know, you may discover a new avenue in those excursions, and they were wonderful. I think it's because of some of the great European novelists he read, like Stendhal and Dostoevsky, who were willing to take those kind of chances that he wanted to do the same thing. And sometimes it led to disaster, but not always. Sometimes it really worked.
Yeah, baggy monsters is what Henry James referred to, the sort of 19th century novels. And you see that a bit with Mailer. Well, let's talk about Gottlieb's book, because it's fair to say you've said it's too baggy, too platitudinous. You mentioned throwing the book across the room when Gottlieb describes someone as having a big personality, a big wardrobe, and an even bigger heart. Why did someone not edit this book better?
I really don't know. I mean, he has a number of people, you know, Jonathan Galassi and Blake Bailey and all these folks that he knows that are in the book business. And I think that he had so many, he's had such a long career. He had so many people that he had to pay tribute to, give accolades to, that got in the way of making the book more about the relationship between editor and writer and the great stories of some of them. And he tells some great stories about some of his authors, you know, about Catch 22 and how he came up with the title of that. Stuff like that is wonderful. But then, you know, you go on for pages and pages where he's giving sales figures and blurbs and stuff like that. And you know, this gal in Miami Beach is a real estate agent. I guess she must have got him a great deal that she got she got into the book somehow. And I, you know, it's that should have come out.
Yeah. I think you're right to point people in the direction of that Paris Review interview instead on The Art of the Editor.
Isn't it wonderful?
It is. Well, it's interspersed, isn't it, with these notes. That's where I found that Morrison line interspersed.
Yes.
So you really get a feel for the relationship.
It's a terrific interview. It's a you know, kind of a breakthrough the way they did it. He's got six or seven writers that he worked with, and they all give comments, and he gives comments back, and they're all interleaved together brilliantly. Mm. And you get at the end, and you feel like you've been in one of the most fabulous dinner parties of literary figures you've ever been to.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks. I mean, I actually found that this piece, you've packed a lot of those anecdotes and I think it's kind of, also, I'm kind of charmed by the fact this great editor, a man who rows with his authors to get them to shut up and prune back, has been allowed to just bang on at inordinate length. There's something kind of charming about that. And I think you capture that in the review.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. You a Mailer fan, dear?
Not particularly.
No, do you know what?
You can get that from my silence.
Do you know what? I'm not stunned to hear that, because you don't strike me. I think there's a lot of ridiculousness.
There's a
lot of macho ridiculousness in Mailer, which I read as a young man and was slightly drawn to. But I think if you're not a young man reading it, I think you would think it's just ridiculous rather than sort of pleasurably ridiculous.
I think that's possibly a fair point.
There's some great stuff. I mean, I once reviewed for the TLS a long time ago. He did a book about Hitler's birth, which and an early childhood, which is just terrible. But part of the
pleasure... Did you review it favourably?
No.
You were able to not,
I was
okay.
able to
distance
to,
yourself.
Yeah, he kept... Yeah, I was... And also actually said in the review that basically the failure is part of Mailer. You kind of get that with
failure Mailer.
Yeah, they half rhyme away from failure, I think I said. But you kind of get that with what Michael was saying there, that sometimes it didn't work, but part of the pleasure was to find out if it might work. And you do get that, I think, with him. But it's a fascinating guy. And that Paris Review thing is cool, isn't it?
It is. And it's so interesting to read about, I find anyway, but then I probably would, the writer-editor relationship. The writer-editor relationship really, really does interest me. And when I was reading this, there's that bit where we're learning about Robert Caro's book and how it needed to be cut so, so drastically. And then it makes you think of, you know, James Ellroy and the writing that can come out of that tough editor stance.
Do you think, is that what produced Ellroy?
So James Ellroy, again, in the Paris Review in an interview, said basically that it was LA Confidential, his editor wanted him to lose 100 pages, and so he just took out his pencil and started cutting words, and that is how his telegraphic style was born.
And that became American Tabloid.
Yeah.
Because what's fascinating about LA Confidential is there's a bit of it. It's not entirely. It's not so stylized.
It doesn't take it so far,
no.
And then you get to the Cold 6000 when it's gone.
No, I love Cold 6000. Now the books after, which I still read quite a lot, are not good. It didn't work with Blood of Rover, which is the third one in the series, and it's not worked in Perfidia, which is the giant prequel to it all. But I think Cold 6000 is almost better. It's not quite better than American Tabloid, but it's on a par, isn't it? Do you not think?
I don't know.
You're getting into an area of
I can tell you're far more passionate than
I.
I just really find it fascinating how style can be born from this discussion.
Yeah,
I love the idea of Robert Gottlieb sitting on the floor eating tuna mayonnaise sandwiches with John le Carré, and John le Carré saying that he would like a clause to be worked into his contract that Gottlieb had to take him out for fancy meals thereafter.
Enough
tuna sandwiches.
Yeah, it's a great detail. That's almost all we have time for this week. Let me thank, on behalf of Thera, me, J. Michael Lennon, David Wheatley and Stone Cold Jane Austen, Devaney Loza. Please do subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back every week with thoughts on big pieces in the TLS and important cultural and artistic issues. This week's paper is now on sale with the pieces we've been discussing, plus Catriona Kelly on the dark history of the Bolshoi, Jackie McCarrick on Edward Bond and David Mamet, Felipe Fernandez Armesto on writing about the Spanish Civil War, Lucy Munro on a rediscovered portrait of Beaumont, and Sheng Yun on the astonishing education system of China. You can visit our website, the-tls.co.uk, to read it all and learn more about our print and digital subscriptions. And do come back daily to the site for new original pieces from TLS writers, including Alan Brown-John on the poetry of Jim Jarmusch, Claire Chambers on the fraught ethics of marriage, and Benjamin Markovitz, who you mentioned earlier, who thinks Ulysses is overrated, as well as The Old Man and the Sea.
And loves Fanny Price.
He loves Fanny Price. Views on Ulysses being overrated, dear?
I wouldn't say it was overrated. No.
Seems
possibly The Old Man and the Sea, I would say, is overrated.
Yeah.
I think this is another one of those...
It's a male-female thing, isn't it?
Although I do love Hemingway, apart from...
Do you like St. Norsa Rises?
Yeah.
See, I think that's a great novel. I think it's one of the great novels.
I think this is the only one of Hemingway that I would say, yes, possibly overrated.
Yeah, that's probably right. I don't think you can overrate Ulysses, because it's kind of so... it stands
so much
alone
has come
as just
from
a,
it as
yeah,
well.
And it's just you a piece possibly. Of genius. I mean, it's
you're
unquestionably
like
overrating
the Iliad. Or
yeah, exactly. It's so unquestionably a work of genius, isn't it?
Yes.
But Benjamin Markowitz doesn't like it. Follow us on Twitter. Do like us on Facebook, and please do review us on iTunes. And join us next week when Thea and I are going to be taking on How to Save Capitalism.
All in a day's work.
Oh, superheroes that we are. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.